Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 43, where we're going to break format slightly and talk about decentralization and centralization in organizations through the lens of the Federalist Papers, specifically Federalist Papers 9 and 10. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Ralph, coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
And this is Pedro, coming to you from Kenilworth in the UK.
And this is Tom, coming to you from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Dimitris, coming to you from Brighton. So, we're engaging in a first ever Talking About Organizations team debate. How exciting is that?
Great!
That's very enthusiastic.
As Ralph mentioned, we're looking at two rather unorthodox texts, which go back to the late 1700s at the time when America, newly independent, was figuring out the way it wants to be organized. And this particular text that we're looking at is part of what's called the Federalist Debate, which is a series of debates that preceded the acceptance of the American Constitution that established federal government. The reason we're looking at this is because we are particularly keen on this podcast to not only explore classical texts, but also break the envelope and see what else we can learn about organizations through looking at things maybe not immediately obvious, as is what we did with our discussion on Oeconomicus by Xenophon a few episodes back. So the way we're going to debate is we have two teams today, and we are going to talk about centralization or decentralization in organizations using the Federalist Papers 9 and 10 that you can find on our website as a basis and as interpretative lensing. We have two special guests who recommended themes for our debates, and while it's going to be epic, it's also going to be friendly, and we hope to have a lot of fun and that you will learn something new from our conversations too.
So the two special guests that Dimitris mentioned just now are Todd Bridgman and Stephen Cummings, authors of the recently released New History of Management. This is a book that takes a critical and historically rigorous view at some of the most fundamental ideas and preconceptions in management and organizational studies. Welcome, Todd and Stephen. Would you like to introduce the debate, please?
My name is Todd Bridgman. I'm a Associate Professor in Victoria Business School at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. And Steve and I are interested in rethinking what has taken to be some of the foundations of the field of management studies. So in our most recent work, we have looked at the origins of perhaps the most famous symbol in our field, which is Maslow's Pyramid of Needs. And what we discovered there when we look back at the historical record is that, contrary to popular opinion, Maslow did not create his pyramid of needs. So part of our research's investigative work, I guess, trying to find the origins of these foundational frameworks, but part of it is also explaining why that matters and what implications that has for how we think about management studies and particularly how we teach management studies to our students. And so I'll pass now to Steve, who will talk a little bit more about this book that we've produced, A New History of Management.
Thanks, Todd. My name is Stephen Cummings, and I work with Todd at Victoria Business School here in New Zealand. And as Todd said, a lot of our research over the last few years has been on looking back at some of the assumptions that that we make about management and how history has encouraged particular assumptions, which often when we go back, prove to not be as foundational as what we might have thought. This year, we pulled together a lot of the things that we've been working on and collected them into a book called A New History of Management with two colleagues of ours from the United Kingdom, John Hazard and Michael Rowlandson. That book, A New History of Management, looks at a whole range of ideas. And when we look at those ideas together, one of the things that we've found is that management studies spent the last 100 years searching for, you know, one best ways. You know, what is the best way to organize a business? What is the best way to be a leader? What is the best way to manage a team? And what we've found when we look at history is that there tends to be this oscillation between, you know, different positions as we kind of rush from one kind of buzzword to the next. And when we put that in historical context, we argue in the book that it suggests to us that maybe there just isn't a one best way to do these things. Maybe these things are contextual and based on cultural beliefs and based on a whole range of different influences. So for us, this theme about centralization versus decentralization is really interesting, because again, it seems like in management studies, we've spent a lot of time debating which is the best way, what should we advise our students and what should we advise managers they should do. Should they centralize or should they decentralize? And history, we believe, would suggest to us that there really isn't one best way. And sometimes we're spending a lot of energy trying to figure out what the one best way is rather than understanding our local context and what might be best for a particular situation. So we're really pleased to introduce this debate. There are a couple of key themes that the debaters are going to be looking at in this podcast. Todd's going to introduce the first one.
So the first one is, in Anglo-American societies, decentralization is often regarded as a positive development and centralization negative. Do you think this view is cultural? Is it right?
And the second theme that the group is going to be discussing is, why do organizations oscillate back and forth between centralization and decentralization? Is there a golden mean? Is there an ideal point that organizations should aim for?
Just to follow on Steve's point, I think, you know, this debate about centralization and decentralization illustrates well the benefits of a critical historical view of management studies, because when we teach students, it's very easy to teach them the idea that is popular and dominant at present. But it's only really when we look back over decades and even centuries that they get a real sense that these ideas go in cycles. And while decentralization might be popular today, there have certainly been periods in the past when it has been the reverse. So taking a critical historical view is good, not just to understand the past, but to be better critical thinkers about management today. And also, you know, there is a real creative aspect to this, that that if we better understand our past, we can be more innovative and creative about the future.
Thank you for these debate topics and taking the time to contribute to this very first podcast debate. They both sound great. So shall we do the teams now?
Teams for today are, on the federalist side, that is the centralization side, we have, in the red corner, Ralph Saul.
That's me.
And supporting him, Pedro.
Me!
The expert on bureaucracy and a formidable opponent for the decentralization camp. I'm not sure what your weights are, so I didn't go for that.
We're in the unlimited intellectual weight class.
Yeah. On the decentralization side, the Confederates camp are Neo.
Right here.
And of course, myself. So it's Ralph and Pedro versus myself and Neo debating centralization versus decentralization in organizations. So before we begin with this epic clash of intellects of the Talking About Organizations podcast, we'll do a quick introduction to the papers and a historical context for those unfamiliar with these particular works. Tom, do you want to get started on that?
Absolutely. We almost take the American democratic system for granted, you know, because it's been so long and, you know, successful in many ways. But the American Constitution wasn't actually the first constitution that the country established. Picture yourself in about 1783, and you've just booted the British king out and all of the redcoats, and now you've got to figure out what kind of a system of government you're going to have. So, what was fresh in everybody's mind, you know, of the newly independent colonists, was their distaste for monarchy and distaste for central oppressive government, and so as the Continental Congress started to form, there were debates that were ongoing as to whether or not the resulting republic should be controlled by a strong central government or a much I don't want to say necessarily weak, because I'm on the decentralization side, but basically that the states, the colonies now becoming independent states, would retain greater autonomy. The result was that the decentralization camp, if you will, won the first round, and the result was what was known as the Articles of Confederation, which was the United States' first constitution. This was basically enacted not very long after the Revolution. It was ratified by the 13 colonies fairly quickly, and it called for a very, very weak central government and autonomy to the states. It wasn't very long before that weak central government was challenged in the form of various rebellions and other acts. I don't want to get into that level of the history. But suffice to say that not very long thereafter, it was apparent that while opposition was still towards against a strong central government in many circles, the Articles of Confederation had left the central government so weak that it couldn't do anything. And therefore, there was a renewed interest in coming up with a new constitution. And that is at the point in which the Federalist Papers come to the fore, because you had the Federalist camp, what was known as the Federalist camp, who was producing papers that were calling for a stronger central government. Opposing them, essentially taking a position that the autonomy of the states was still paramount, were branded the Anti-Federalists. And so the Federalist Papers were the products of the Federalist community. The Anti-Federalists were producing their own papers. The Constitution would ultimately wind up with a very interesting compromise between the two camps, in that there was a stronger central government, but there was checks and balances that were put in place in order to preserve some degree of state autonomy. And I think I'll kind of pass it over to Ralph for anything to add. But that's kind of the brief history.
Right. Just a couple things to add to Tom's excellent summary is that the Articles of Confederation were largely an extension of the legislature that the colonials had created during the Revolutionary War. That may be one reason why it was ratified so quickly. And it was the government the United States used from 1781 to 1789. When the defects of the Articles of Confederation that Tom mentioned were identified, and I'm going to mention a couple more, the Congress actually convened a body to recommend modifications to the Articles of Confederation. They did not actually grant the body permission to come up with an entirely new form of government. And there were many people who were appalled at what came out of the Constitutional Convention, because what they thought they were going to see was amendments proposed to the Articles of Confederation and not the completely different constitution and form of government. A couple of the key issues: the states really were the ones that were sovereign in the Continental in the Articles of Confederation. So the Congress could say that or pass taxes, but the states were solely responsible for collecting them. Congress had no power to collect taxes. Tom talked about treaties being ineffective. Essentially, there was no enforcement mechanism for the few treaties that were in place. The United States was having difficulty paying its debts from the war. We owed a lot of money to foreign powers, and the states and the Congress could direct the printing of money, which caused rampant inflation. And there was no president. So if you can imagine a parliament, say, of England, and no prime minister or no executive branch, really, it meant the states had to agree on just about everything. They also had a rule where each state had one vote in the legislature. So you could have more than one representatives and you could have committees and that sort of thing. But when it came time to vote, every state just got a single vote. So I think those were people at the time recognized that there were defects in the way that the Articles of Confederation were written. And it does come down to this idea of centralization, and I'm Pedro and I are on the pro-centralization camp. Is the government more effective? Do you get better results? So whether it's government or an organization, you get better results when you have more power centralized to enact important things and, in this particular case, treaties and stuff. That's why the Federalist Papers 9 and 10, which talk about factions and centralization, are really important, because they have a very good analog for organizations, and we'll be talking about that.
Yeah, and it's also worth mentioning that government is, in a way, a type of organization, even though it may have some peculiarities that are different from private sector organizations. There's so much in common in terms of the centralization decentralization debate that we'll have very little trouble coming up with good analogies between the two.
Okay, so let's go to theme number one. In Anglo-American societies, decentralization is often regarded as a positive development and centralization negative. Do you think this view is cultural? Is it right?
From the centralization camp, I do think it's cultural. In the Anglo-American case, decentralization, even though I'm not a big fan of that, I believe that is part of our culture, because we value autonomy a great deal in the United States and in England and some of the other former colonies. And there are other countries, particularly Oriental societies, where cohesion and coherence are highly valued, and a lot of decision making is centralized in those kinds of organization. So I do see some very strong cultural indicators or cultural proclivities. And I do think in many cases, centralization is the way to go, because you get coherence in decisions. You have a line of authority to the person that made the decision. You can have better control over things that need tighter control. And therefore, I think centralization is a positive development, more so than a negative one.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely wonderful if you're a king. The issue is, from the side of an anti-federalist, for example, is let's set aside the notion that the Articles of Confederation as a particular document did not work out as planned. However, when we talk about centralization, where is the line drawn between a central idea that drives the benefit of society or the benefit of the organization, such as, in this case, freedom, liberty, and when centralization becomes yet another form of oppressive authority, such as the monarch that the colonists just kicked back out to the United Kingdom? When does it end? Where's the line drawn between the absolute good of the union and the good of the one who is running the union? Where does that line drawn? And so the position of the anti-federalists was this great fear of the chief executive, as would be known as a president, would basically become a new monarch, and we would simply, instead of having an external entity imposing himself upon the colonies, we would now have the states all imposing its own central authority upon itself, which would be just as stifling.
So a quick reaction to that, and I think that's another dimension of the cultural aspect of centralization and decentralization that perhaps Ralph didn't cover, but I'd like to cover, which is, I think the argument is cultural laden because we have specific ideas of what counts as centralization or decentralization. So, for instance, the metaphor of the king and the issue of monarchy and the way decentralization might be done in a presidential system or in a specific kind of company in which there is a very strong headquarters. We can also think that the matter is not so much whether there is someone in power imposing specific ideas, but what kind of mechanisms exist for giving voice to in this case, the different states, or in a typical corporation case, the different departments or different groups that make up that system. So I'm attacking that sideways in a way to say that it's not only the point whether it is someone in power and therefore it's good or bad, but also the question we could be asking is how that person comes to power and who is setting the agenda that's being discussed in that sort of forums.
I will go with that, Pedro, and I'm going to see you and raise the following, if you will. So culture, or something viewed as cultural, of course, is not necessarily referring to national cultures or things like that. It can also be organizational cultures, as you, I think, pointed out here in what you said. But culture is essentially a historical pattern of previous decisions. And the thing with centralized, or a pattern that emerges out of a centralized system, is that it is necessarily, by definition, a pattern of a very limited set of decisions that are made visible. So it ignores, suppresses, oppresses, depending on your point of view or the particular situation, a whole bunch of other agencies of many different groups and other people. And I think the question really that is at the heart of whether it's a positive or a negative development has to do with the particular view that we have of the people who comprise these organizations or states or whatever. How much, to follow up on Tom's argument, so not only where the line is drawn, but how much do we, how much faith do we have in individuals? Do we think of individuals as someone who would cooperate for the benefit of their own collective good? Or do we think of individuals as someone who will kind of, in this more Hobbesian perspective, this Leviathan, act in destructive self-interest? And the answer that the centralization assumption would presuppose is that individuals acting together for the benefit of their collective good essentially will not. The centralization requires some kind of some automation of decision making and conflict resolution and all of that, and that is done through the perspective it's essentially very patronizing to the idea of a responsible, autonomous, well considered individual.
I think that was a good point, and I think one of the things you all are drawing attention to is that it's probably not tenable to say that you're in favor of having everything centralized, that it is perhaps worth strategic consideration of what should be centralized and who should be doing the centralizing. I do think in the case of centralization, the pro-centralization considerations are you want to have consistent messaging within the organization. Demetrius, you talked about how you have these autonomous individuals and you have to wonder, are they going to get the message right? Are they going to understand how the company, what the company culture is, or the ethos, or what's trying to be produced all on their own? Or does some, if not all of that, need to be centralized? And I'll give you that's especially the case with new technology, and we'll talk about, I think, some technology issues later. But an example was, for me, IBM, when IBM was repurposing itself and reorganizing in the 90s and 00 timeframe, what they found out was they were so decentralized that actually it was confusing their customers because the different divisions of IBM were competing against each other and could not set a consistent message and product delivery approach for the customers. And that was something that had grown over time because in many ways, decentralization was seen as a good because people had these autonomous ideas and they could innovate and those kinds of things. But then when it came time to present a message to the outside world, it was not consistent and therefore confusing customers, which is generally not good for business or keeping yourself organized. I think also there's the second point I want to make is that there are certain things that you don't want too much autonomy on, although you want to be flexible to new ideas. And that is, for example, safety practices. Depending on the kind of work you're engaged in or where it's done, we wouldn't want to see everybody doing everything differently because then people in the organization, they could transfer to different parts and then be completely confused about what the safety rules are. And it might also, you might have some organizations or parts of the organization that were safer than others. And if you just said, well, that's all up to the individual organization, which was often the case in Alcoa, then you end up having lots of deaths as a result. And so Alcoa had a very strong, maybe this is oxymoronic, but a very strong culture of decentralization where the individual units were allowed to decide things like that. And they had a horrific safety record. So it's probably not the best to say everything should be centralized. I do think, though, there are some really important things that the business and organizations derive great benefit from having centralized.
I think the complexity that needs to be introduced at this point is, of course, what we mentioned in the beginning. What does centralization mean? Are we centralizing power? Are we centralizing decisions? Are we centralizing initiative and agency? What is it? Because in the case of safety standards, I think the key word is standards, and standards do not necessarily need to be centralized.
Yeah, perhaps not. So let's look at the Federalist perspective first, and then we'll move on to an organization. So not all power was centralized in the proposed new form of government, and that's not what the Federalists were arguing. They were arguing that some level of centralization needed to happen, and their argument, which was largely theoretical and qualitative, was that the dual sovereignty of the states and the federal government would be managed through the checks and balances that Tom talked about earlier. And I think when you look at organizations, you could centralize everything. I mean, there are some organizations, McDonald's is typically a pretty good example, where when they were initializing their very large franchise operations, there was one way to flip a hamburger, there was one way to serve the fries. Everything was very regimented, and that enabled them to produce consistent quality that was, prior to that time, unknown in what is now called the fast food industry. It may not be the best thing for today's time, but at that time it was very beneficial for McDonald's and enabled significant growth. And I think there's also certain kinds of decision-making, maybe not all decision-making, but that you do want vested in the chief executive or the senior members of the organization. That's why, for example, in the new constitution that was to replace the Articles of Confederation, the president had sole authority over the armed forces, which made people very nervous, but Congress had the ability to raise the money to fund them. And Congress had the ability, only Congress in the United States has the ability to declare war. The chief executive cannot do that. And there's an example of checks and balances where you have the function of being the commander-in-chief of the military when it's actually engaged, vested only in the chief executive of the country, the president. But the finances and the raising of the armies and those kinds of things, that's delegated to Congress, and only Congress can declare war. So I think there's certain kinds of things. And so for another example of corporations, right, if you're going to make a multi-million-dollar decision that's going to affect the health of the corporation, that's something you want to have centralized or at least largely controlled in the board of directors or the president, chief executive officer, because I think anarchy would result, me being the centralization fan, if that was all done at the unit level.
I'm not so sure I agree that it would be anarchy. As a matter of fact, to kind of go back to the discussion of standards, and basically when I think about certain standards, if you are trying to manage standards of care or standards of safety or other things, would it not be better if you vested the experts within the industry to go ahead and negotiate and develop those standards based on their direct access or direct communication with customers or those they serve, rather than have it centrally vested in some government bureaucracy, say, to arbitrarily impose the standards upon the industry at the government's convenience or its own timeline? One of the things that I get concerned about when we're talking about centralizing so much power in the government is that it becomes isolated potentially from the interests in which it should be serving. And there's a number of cases in industry where the best thing and the most effective, the most efficient way for it to provide better service and to provide for better safety or what have you is to initiate innovations from the bottom, negotiate these safety standards, et cetera, in order to immediately impact what would be provided to the customer, as opposed to waiting for a government agency who could take years to, you know, okay some new important drug or something like that. There's arguments to be made that centralization does not necessarily benefit from having the power and decision-making authority centralized at the expense of good innovation, good ideas, diversity of views, et cetera, being fostered throughout the republic.
So a response to that, I think that the important thing is, in what Tom was saying, there seems to be an assumption that centralization means top-down governance. But actually, we can think the other way around. Centralization can also include a more bottom-up approach. Because it's, I think that the idea that experts should be the ones leading standards, how they're designed, how they're implemented, how they're changed, or the idea that, you know, we need diversity of opinions, we basically mostly agree. I think everyone would agree with that. But the point is that these negotiations need to happen somewhere, and then there must be mechanisms to enforce them. So the point is not just whether to allow for decentralization, but actually centralization can be a condition for diversity of opinions, because people meet in specific conditions and different parties have the, you know, the space allowed for discussions. There are mechanisms to make sure that things are documented and also fed back and regulated. So in a way, you can think that the things that you are saying, such as space for negotiation and more expert-led kind of ideas, can actually link very well with centralization.
Right, but this still presupposes that there has to be some kind of a central mandate to do things, right? Why do we need to have a mechanism or a space or a standardized or kind of centrally designed format for dialogue? Is it not enough to have people in a society or in an organization that who depend on the performance of that organization to self-organize and conduct business for their own benefit without having a centrally imposed mandate on doing so? I think that might be one of the cultural dimensions, that why should there be someone to say that it's okay to do this and it's not okay to do that?
Well, I'm going to push back again on the issue of, just quickly on, because I don't think there necessarily has to be someone. And I think the whole point of having a centralization actually can be somewhere where the debates can happen. And here, I think what is important is that if you don't have that, of course, discussions can still take place and they can be very generative, but they are always a might. And we don't want it to leave to chance things like safety, for instance, you know?
Yeah, I think Pedro makes a good point it's the forum you create for the other ideas, this bubbling up of creativity. And I think also Demetrius made a good point about though I'm loath to concede that to the opposite side, but I think that he made a good point about the cultural aspects of it. So you were talking about why would it be good to have a single person making decisions, or why would it be better to centralize power and decision making authority? And I would say there are many organizations and cultures where cohesion is it's a very greatly valued thing, and that cohesion is built, fostered, developed by having a strong central executive or decision-making body that helps align everybody. So I think we shouldn't look at centralization and concentration of power purely as a dictatorial. I think there's a aspect of it where it actually helps align people and get everybody going in the same direction. And going back to the reference to the Federalist Papers, the Federalists were very concerned about the over-centralization of power. They strongly distrusted the ability of men normal human beings to responsibly exercise that power or do so without falling into either a despotism or tyranny. And that's why they put checks and balances in. So I do believe organizations, you can have a lot of centralization as long as you build in some checks and balances or ways, like Pedro was talking about. Hey, if some organization says, hey, we have to get this better safety idea, it doesn't mean you have to have an organization where you don't listen to them. You can create a forum, which I would argue is a form of check and balance.
Yeah, but we've got to be careful, though, because Madison in Federalist Number 10 seems to contradict himself in a very important way. So in one sentence, he says, by a faction, and faction was very important, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or minority of the whole, are actuated by some common impulse or passion or of interest that is averse, which is to say, in opposition of the rights of other citizens. And yet at the further down in the paper, he says, no man is allowed to be a judge in his own cause because his interest was certainly bias his judgment. So what I hear between these two sentences is, on the one hand, if we do have a disagreement, a very, very strong disagreement between states, looking up to the union, or basically at the state level or between a state and a union, then Madison would seem to argue that that is a faction. And therefore, two methods of curing the mischiefs of faction, so which, it's obviously they're taking it in the form of a pejorative. One is by removing the cause, which is a very thinly veiled threat against those who would raise a dispute, or by the other by controlling its effects, essentially shouting down. And yet, this central union, the central union would have the power essentially to determine what is factionist and what is not, and yet not be expected not to be basically to be unbiased in doing so. And, I just think of various states like especially at the time you had states like Rhode Island that was a very, very, culturally a certain way. And then you have some of the other states that were still somewhat loyalist during the Revolution down in the South, who really didn't play very much in the Revolution. And so there's a whole bunch of different perspectives that are being brought to bear in this new union, that imposing some sort of centralized focus is not going to necessarily bring everybody in line or build a common message beyond, say, a common vision of freedom and liberty. But the desire or the pursuit of something that's a bit more centralized in terms of things that would actually affect how the states try to govern their own people is for sure going to create divisions. And is that not necessarily better off being addressed at state level, where the state governments could very well be powerful according to the will of the citizenry and can provide for the direct needs without having to have this grander union do it for them?
Right. And I'm so happy that you brought in Federalist 10 here, because I'd like to use this opportunity to take issue with Pedro's statement that somehow decentralization equals chance and centralization equals design. This doesn't have to be that way. In fact, centralization, by nature being exclusive, is far more chance-based than decentralization, which is almost a Darwinian way of decision-making and derivation of practices and standards. In fact, we know from institutional theory that decentralized units or unconnected units will still tend to harmonize in the way that they do things. So institutional isomorphism, which essentially comes to reinforce that decentralized units working towards their self-interest still generates outcomes similar or even more effective than those of centralized organizations. And as Tom identified in Madison's argument, a centralized organization is still just another faction, the difference being that it's a faction that can operate at the expense of other factions.
So the addition of institutional theory is a bit, it expands the discussion, because then we have to talk about multiple organizations, and then in this case there is no center because there is a whole complete open ecology, so to speak. But in my vests of a pro-centralist person in this debate, I have to say that the counter-argument would be, in isomorphism, there is still centralization driving it, because many of the vectors that create that kind of, you know, similarities between organizations are many times professional bodies, regulatory agencies, all the kind of supra-organizations, so to speak, in which we can interpret as a supra, somehow centralist force that make those ideas actually be diffused. They are not just diffused by virtue of existing, but are specific social forces that make sure that the people know about them and that they are perceived as legitimate. That's the whole point of the debate. You know, there are central forces that make sure that they are perceived in a certain way. So just to, you know, rebuttal your point.
Sure, but it's centralized by consequence, not by design. And that's the key thing here, that we don't take issue with centralization absolutely.
Well, I was just going to say, one comment I want to make about Demetrius's earlier statement that the centralized authority is another form of faction. I suppose that you can look at it that way, but I certainly don't get that out of reading Federalist 9 and 10, that the central authority and the way it was constructed or was proposed to be constructed by electing people from a wider variety of the states was definitely did not seem to me to be reflective of another faction. This is not the way that I saw it being written. I think you could interpret it that way, but I don't believe that's what Madison and Hamilton are arguing.
The problem of the debate is that, you know, it becomes clear now when we introduce new things what we are talking about. Metaphor, what kind of organization, what kind of setting, centralization for what, centralization for when, and then it becomes harder to differentiate. But on the issue whether centralization is designed or not, and that is related to chance or not, I was going to say that the relevant point here is that without some kind of agreed upon kind of central institution, and then I agree that it can emerge very much from the bottom up, and then it can become, you know, how can I say, formalized after. So the origins, I agree, are not necessarily, they don't have to be designed on the table. They can very much be emergent. But the point is that there has to be a place in time and through specific mechanisms that become accepted as, you know, the authority that can speak for certain things, the representative of the certain kinds. And then that's when centralization happens.
I think that's you're making a good point, actually, that you can have designed centralization and you can also have atomistic centralization where it's emergent. And I think that was actually one of the big concerns in the debate on the anti-federalist side. They were very worried that the Constitution that was proposed was too vague, that it actually wasn't clear enough about the nature of the powers, and therefore you could have this bottom-up accretion of power where it could lead to despotism or the people who were in charge in the executive branch from taking too much power. And this is actually a very current debate we have in the United States, where the Constitution as written says that Congress makes all the laws. It's very clearly spelled in the Constitution. However, Congress has then largely and informally delegated that to the executive branch through the requirement to write regulations, which have the force of law. So there are many constitutional scholars that say that is Congress delegating its power for law, legislation without authorization to the executive branch. So that's actually a very current and topical debate in the United States. And so I do think you have those kinds of risk in organizations as well, where you'll go beyond what the formal authority was. And what the framers' argument was in the Federalist Papers is the checks and balances will take care of that. They make a very strong argument that you'll get wiser and more noble and just people because they'll be elected from a broader category of or broader number of the populace because you'll have this bigger republic. I'm required to argue that because I'm a centralist guy.
I was going to say was just to just to remind the audience that just because we're taking the particular side doesn't mean we necessarily agree with what we're saying. I think what this kind of shows is just looking at it from centralization and decentralization. It's actually a far more complex debate. There's so many different ways of thinking about the two alleged sides that it's to what degree is something centralized? To what degree does something decentralized become centralized? It is kind of fascinating to think about, this in the context of a government or the formation of a government, and how that particular debate is just perpetuated over the course of century, a couple of centuries now. It was at the heart of the American Civil War, the distinguishment between, the strong central union versus the rights of the individual states, and it's playing out now in today's political environment. It's been a very, very enduring debate, and I don't know that I see necessarily that it's the type of a debate that could ever really be resolved.
Well, the way it's presented in management literature, generally, the question of centralization versus decentralization is a question of contingency. So, first of all, as we surfaced in our debate, is what are we talking about in terms of what is being centralized or decentralized? Is it authority? Is it resources? Is it accountability? Is it the way decisions flow up or down? Is it design or consequence? So we mentioned all of these things. What we didn't really mention is, in terms of organizations, in response to what would the decision to centralize or decentralize, or the emergence of it as a property, would be kind of enacted? Is it something organizations start off naturally, as Henri Fayol would suggest, that centralization is just how things are supposed to be in organizations? Or is it something that is selected or arrived at maybe through institutional forces or just as a matter of necessity? As the question suggested, whether this is a cultural thing that decentralization is positive and centralization is negative. Again, the question there is that what do we mean by that? Certainly, national cultures would offer one solution, but since we're talking about organizations here, organizational cultures do, I think you will agree, tend to gravitate towards the centralization part simply because of the balances and imbalances of power and of what organizational culture is that we discussed plenty in our debates in episodes 30, 11, and so there's much to it here, and it's certainly not a yes or no or one way or another way question, and there is much to consider in terms of what goes into one and the other.
Yeah, you guys have used a lot of the same summation points I would, just to pile on a bit. So it is a complex issue. Not as easy to say, well, it should be all one way and all the other. And I think you do see that in the Federalist debates where the anti-Federalists and the Federalists are going at it, but not all power was being centralized. What was alarming the anti-Federalists, in this case that would be Demetrius and Neo, was that they felt it was too much power was being centralized. And that's really what Demetrius was talking about. How much and how do you go about doing that? And I think the centralization argument would be, it's not neither good or bad thing. It depends on how you do it. And it also depends on whether you have mechanisms that help you get information from other sources, that it's not all the people at the top of the organization or the pyramid of power that make all the decisions, because that's probably untenable in the kind of world that we live in. And that's all for part one of episode 43. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue having our debate about centralization and decentralization in organizations using the Federalist Papers 9 and 10 here on Talking About Organizations.